Good afternoon. Welcome to The World Today. I'm Thomas O'Riti. This Friday, the political fight in the US is heating up, with Donald Trump labelling his rival for president as a puppet intent on destroying the American way of life. But with Joe Biden under the spotlight of the Democratic Convention, can he convince Americans he's the man for the job? And with efforts underway to develop a COVID vaccine, how do we ensure it'll get to those most at risk?
If the virus is circulating outside of the country in an uncontrolled fashion, then you're not safe even if you have relatively high coverage with an effective vaccine. The way we believe this should be done is that all countries get vaccines equally, to start off with their health workers and high-risk individuals, which should be enough to dampen down the infections around the world.
Well, as the pandemic continues to dominate our coverage, the issue of aged care remains in the spotlight. And today, the aged care minister has struggled to respond to questions about his government's response to the COVID crisis in aged care homes. The Royal Commission into the sector recently heard evidence that hygiene measures weren't followed soon enough. And the Minister, Richard Colbeck, is now giving evidence for a second time at a parliamentary inquiry examining the government's response to the pandemic. Our reporter Isabel Rose following his evidence. She's with me now. Afternoon, Isabel. So I understand the Minister was unable to say how many residents of aged care had died after contracting coronavirus.
Yeah, this is a figure the committee obviously expected would be front of mind for the Minister, but he did seem somewhat unprepared for this appearance in front of the committee. He's being asked about his department's response to the aged care crisis over the last few months as infections rose, particularly in Victoria. And Chair of the committee, Labor Senator Katie Gallagher, asked the minister to update the committee on how many residents of aged care facilities had died as a result of the virus, and he didn't have the figures in front of him. So I've shortened the length of the pause for you, but after what was actually about 30 seconds of paper rustling, you'll hear a department official have to step in.
Minister, how many residents of aged care facilities funded and regulated by the Australian government have passed away from COVID-19?
I'll just have to look up my latest report, Chair. That might take me a moment.
Could an official help if the Minister's not able to? Ms Lavin?
Amy Laffin, Acting First Assistant Secretary of the Aged Care Reform and Compliance Division. As at 8 a.m. on the 20th of August, 258 care recipients had passed away. Of those, 254 were residential care recipients.
Okay, so Isabel, the Minister has also been quizzed on what the federal government did when it started to become worried about the spread of the virus in aged care.
Yeah, Minister Richard Colbeck has said this morning that it was in June when he and others first began to worry about the rate of spread within aged care homes. The Royal Commission into Aged Care heard last week that there wasn't a clear plan about what roles the state and federal authorities were to play in the event of an outbreak. And in fact, the Commission heard that there was confusion about who was actually in charge when an outbreak did occur. There was evidence about hygiene measures not being followed and masks for staff not being made mandatory early enough, and that didn't happen until July. The Minister has told the inquiry he doesn't believe that you could have limited the number of facilities that contracted an infection because it reflects the rate of community transmission. Senator Katie Gallagher doesn't agree, obviously, and has questioned the Minister about what he did in June when he started to become concerned. This is part of their exchange.
We're meeting weekly with the aged care providers to continue to talk to them about the issues that were occurring and receiving any feedback from them about concerns that they had. The code of conduct was for visitation was put into place. That was a national process that was negotiated between the providers and...
But, Minister, none of this is about ramping up the response specifically linked to community transmission. I've heard the Prime Minister, I've heard Professor Murphy, I've heard you say we couldn't help it because the community transmission levels rose. As it rose in June, I'm trying to establish exactly what happened in terms of the government that's in charge. What was your response to that increased risk? And I'm not sure you've been able to show me or direct me to anything other than a couple of letters went out to providers.
Well, we continue to provide advice to the sector around infection control. We continue to talk to the sector about the importance of infection control, of visitor restrictions.
Okay, so of course there's a Royal Commission into aged care at the moment as well, and last week it heard there was no clear direction for facility managers about whether to move sick residents to hospital or treat them where they were. Has today's evidence shed any light on that?
Yes, the Deputy Secretary of the Ageing and Aged Care sector in the Federal Health Department, Michael Lai, has told the inquiry that, in fact, after the outbreak at Newmarch House in Sydney, where 19 residents died, the lesson learned was, in fact, that residents should be taken to hospital for treatment, not kept in their rooms like they were at Newmarch. Keep in mind, though, that was in April. Residents who've caught coronavirus in other aged care homes since have been hospitalised in some cases, but it's been up to each resident to decide. And an agreement between state and federal governments on that is still a work in progress.
Okay, Isabel Rowe reporting there. Thank you. At the Disability Royal Commission today, there's a similar theme to what we've just heard in Canberra with regards to aged care. The inquiry's questioning senior officers of the Federal Health Department about just how prepared our health system has been to help people with disabilities during the pandemic. It's heard there was no plan which specifically addressed the needs of people with disabilities when the outbreak began. Rachel Mealy is following that hearing and she joins me now. Afternoon, Rach. So this is the first time that senior figures in the Federal Health Department have taken the stand. What have they said about the planning for the disability sector?
Well, Tom, Simon Cottrell is the First Assistant Secretary of the Commonwealth Department of Health, and he's been on the stand at the Royal Commission this morning. He's been questioned about just what you've mentioned, the department's approach to the pandemic and what measures it put in place to account for the needs of people with disabilities. He's admitted that a plan for the health department's response was put together early on, but he's also admitted that the disability sector wasn't mentioned at all.
As I understand it, it was prepared very quickly and under great pressure, but by staff conscientiously doing their best. I think it is an omission that disability is not mentioned.
So, Rach, what Simon Cottrell said about the availability of data that is specific to the disability sector?
Well, essentially, that not much exists, Tom. He has said, and this has been a problem that's been raised by advocates across the disability sector. They argue that you just can't make a solution to fit a problem if you have no idea about the scale of it. And indeed, under questioning today, Simon Cottrell has admitted that data just hasn't been collected.
How many people with disability have contracted COVID-19 since the 22nd of January?
And the answer is that we don't know.
So, Tom, Kate Eastman, the council assisting, went on to ask him about how many people with disabilities had died since the pandemic began. And again, he said he didn't know, although there were some figures from the National Disability Insurance Scheme in relation to this. And just finally, Tom, another avenue of questioning has focused on infection control training for disability support workers. Simon Cottrell says that more work needs to be done to ensure that support workers have the right level of training, and he described it as being a live issue within the department.
Okay, Rachel Mealy reporting there. Thank you. The inquiry into Victoria's botched hotel quarantine program has heard security guards failed to help a returned traveller who'd injured herself on a supervised walk. Now, the inquiry is investigating what went wrong in the program that allowed the virus to spread into the Melbourne community. Samantha Donovan's following the hearings in Melbourne. She joins me now. Sam, afternoon. There's been more evidence today of people who had medical problems in hotel quarantine. What's the inquiry been told?
Yes, Tom, we've already heard at the inquiry from or about several people in hotel quarantine who weren't given adequate medical and mental health support. They've included a person threatening suicide, a woman with endometriosis who was in excruciating pain, a pregnant woman who just wanted to have a bath to ease her discomfort, as well as people, for example, with diabetes whose dietary needs were ignored by those supervising the return travellers. This morning, the inquiry
Murray's heard evidence from Sue and Ron Erasmus. They were returned travellers who spent a fortnight in quarantine at the Stanford Plaza in Melbourne. Now, that's the hotel epidemiologists say about 10% of Melbourne's second wave of infections can be traced back to. Now, Mr. Erasmus has given evidence this morning that he sought some counselling during his time in quarantine because his father had died just a short time before and he was also suffering from some other stresses. But he told the inquiry he had to keep explaining his need for a counsellor over and over again to so many different staff, 14 times in fact he had to explain that his father had died, and he became so frustrated he gave up and didn't get any help, even though his wife was quite worried about his mental state. Mrs. Erasmus herself was injured while in quarantine. She was out on a supervised break with her family, but she fell and fractured her foot. Counsel assisting the inquiry, Ben Isle, asked her if the security guards supervising the residents had helped her, but she gave evidence that they didn't, and her husband had to carry her 10 flights back up to their room. She was later taken to hospital and came back to the hotel on crutches, but she told the inquiry the hotel quarantine program didn't help her.
We had asked if they could accommodate us with an easier to access shower, but they said that they would only accommodate two of us. And because I needed help, it would have been Ron and me, and the children would have been alone. So we declined that offer. So I ended up, when I got out of the bath with the crutches, twisting myself and my GP, when we got back home eventually, said I'd slipped a disc. It was painful.
Returned traveller Sue Erasmus. Briefly, Sam, what's the latest on the case numbers in Victoria?
179 new cases today, Tom. That is some good news. It's the first time in 5 weeks the daily case numbers are below 200. Very sadly, though, another 9 deaths, and 7 of those people were nursing home residents.
Okay, Samantha Donovan in Melbourne. Thank you. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks very much for your company. The pandemic, it's dominated our coverage for months, and the whole time one critical question keeps coming up. When will we see a vaccine? Now, this week, as we've been covering, the Australian government threw its support behind the UK-based drug company AstraZeneca to locally produce a vaccine developed by scientists at Oxford University. But there's still a long way to go. So to find out more about the challenges ahead, I spoke to a man who spent years at the forefront of disease prevention. Dr. Seth Berkley is an epidemiologist and an expert in vaccine development. He's also the CEO of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and he joined me earlier from Geneva.
Extraordinary progress has been made. So if you think about the normal timeline for vaccines being 7 to 10 years, we already have 29 vaccines in clinical trials, and we have 6 of them in efficacy trials. That's the last stage of clinical testing. The challenge is we don't know whether any of those vaccines are going to work. Now, the good news is data that is coming in from the earlier stage trials have been promising, and it's been promising for multiple candidates. So I suspect, you know, early next year, we might see vaccines begin to be rolled out.
The big development here at the moment is the Australian government now says it's at the front of the queue with AstraZeneca to secure Oxford University's potential vaccine. Is there a particular team or a particular country where you're seeing the greatest hope and the most progress at the moment?
You have to have protection everywhere for people to feel safe. So this is a really important difference from other diseases. In this case, if the virus is raging out of control, you know, you will not be able to go back to normal. You won't be able to have trade, tourism, travel. And so it becomes really important to make sure that there is vaccine available everywhere, because you're never going to have 100% coverage of a vaccine, nor is a vaccine going to be 100% effective.
Yeah. That links to my next question, because I'm interested in this issue of vaccine nationalism, though. I mean, let's say a vaccine for COVID-19 COVID-19's developed. What do we need to keep in mind when it comes to equitable access? Are you concerned that countries might just focus on protecting their own citizens rather than taking a global approach?
Well, that is exactly the concern, because if the virus is circulating outside of the country in an uncontrolled fashion, then you're not safe even if you have relatively high coverage with an effective vaccine. Rather than having one country go to 100% and another country go to 100%, the way we believe this should be done is that all countries get vaccines equally to start off with their health workers and high-risk individuals, rising up towards 20% of their populations, which should be enough to dampen down the infections around the world.
When we're looking at ensuring global equitable access to this vaccine, your organization is behind what's called the COVAX facility. Tell me about that.
So what we're trying to do is make sure that nobody gets left behind. And we started out thinking about the low and lower middle income countries. And we also added into that group the small island economies that are IDA eligible from the World Bank. So that's 92 countries. But we realized that there might not be vaccine for them. So we put out an expression of interest for those. And to our pleasure, we had 173 countries express written interest in joining this effort to try to buy vaccines together. The idea will be to have a portfolio of 12 to 15 vaccines that can provide the largest portfolio, therefore the largest likelihood of success, and try to work with countries to have them get access to vaccines for up to 20% of their populations. And the idea is to purchase 2 billion doses of vaccine, 1 billion for high income, 1 billion for low income countries by the end of 2021.
The numbers we're hearing every day are quite extraordinary. People are still dying. How are you feeling about this pandemic at the moment? Are we getting on top of this?
I think if we have to look globally, the answer is we're not on top of it. And part of the problem is it's not easy to control. So every country has to use all the tools at their disposal. Every time we see complacency, we then see spikes in cases. So unfortunately, the world is going to continue to have to work on using these public health approaches until we have effective vaccines to get this completely under control.
Okay, Seth Berkley, thanks very much for speaking to the world today.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Seth Berkley, the CEO of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. Turning to the US now, and it's the final night of the Democratic National Convention and a big moment for the presidential nominee Joe Biden. North America correspondent Catherine Diss joined me a short time ago. Catherine, tonight's the final night of the Democratic Convention. It's all about Joe Biden. What's his focus tonight?
Yeah, look, Tom, he's really casting himself as the more capable leader, the person who can manage the multiple crises at hand that America is currently experiencing, and someone who really knows the system, can pass legislation, can cut deals. He's promising to restore the soul of the nation, return unity, and really bridge those huge divides that we've seen become so apparent in the country over the past 4 years. And he's really going to draw on his experience of terrible family tragedy to do that. He lost his wife and young child in a car accident, and then subsequently his adult son Beau died of brain cancer in 2015. So he's going to use those experiences as a way of showing the country that he has the empathy and compassion required to lead the nation. He grieved those losses very publicly as a senator, and it's a way he's really connected with people on that level. And that's really the pitch, Tom, that the party has been making, that he's fundamentally a decent man who is right for this moment. He's a moderate candidate, but he's also talking big on climate change and gun control as he seeks to try and, you know, appease those more liberal wings of the party and the newer, younger generation of voters.
Yeah, and at yesterday's convention, former US President Barack Obama made some critical comments about President Trump. He called him a threat to democracy. Today, Donald Trump's been hitting back at his political opponents in the Democratic Party. Now, what's he had to say?
Yeah, look, he has indeed. It actually started last night when he was live tweeting throughout Barack Obama and Kamala Harris's speeches. He's continued those attacks today while touring the battleground state of Pennsylvania. But he heavily focused on Joe Biden. He said that he claims to be from Pennsylvania, but he abandoned the state. In truth, he left the state when he was 10 years old with his family. He said he would be a disaster for Americans on taxes, gun rights. He would aid migrants' abortion and destroy energy production. He described life under a Biden presidency as being like the smouldering ashes of Minneapolis, the angry anarchy of Portland, and the blood-stained sidewalks of Chicago. And all of this, Tom, continues to break with decorum. Usually the opposition lays low during the other's convention.
And beyond the convention, it has been a difficult day for President Trump. Firstly, with a legal setback about his tax records. What's happened there?
Yeah, most certainly hasn't been a good 24 hours for the president. The judge found his legal team failed to show that the subpoena was issued in bad faith and was overly broad. And that was his legal team's argument. And this is in relation to an investigation by a Manhattan district attorney to access his tax records over hush money payments that he made to two women ahead of the 2016 election. So the judge's decision today paves the way for those documents to be released. But Donald Trump has already announced he will be fighting it. And in terms of Steve Bannon, he was one of President Trump's closest advisors at the start of his term and really the man who propelled him to the White House. It was his vision of populist nationalism that really cut through the politics in a way that America had never really seen it done before. And he and Donald Trump were more or less inseparable before he was sacked by the president 8 months into his term in office. But he's now been charged along with three others of defrauding a GoFundMe campaign which raised millions of dollars to build a private border wall between Mexico and the US. He was arrested on a yacht off the east coast of the United States along with his co-conspirators today. Prosecutors say that the four skimmed large amounts of donations for themselves to buy things like luxury boats and cars. It found them guilty of two conspiracy charges. Bannon and the others now face up to 20 years prison on each of those charges. Bannon has subsequently pleaded not guilty to those charges as he becomes the latest in a string of former Trump officials to be indicted.
North America correspondent Catherine Diss. Well, back home, an illegal showdown's brewing between environmentalists and the logging industry, with former Greens leader Bob Brown launching legal action that could spell the end for regional forest agreements. Now, loggers say it's economic vandalism at a time when jobs are prized more than ever. But the former senator says the agreements run foul of federal environmental laws that are designed to protect native habitat and endangered animals. He's our political reporter, Tom Eagledon.
For almost 20 years, regional forest agreements have acted as a kind of peace treaty between the logging industry, governments and environmentalists. But it's been an uneasy peace at best, and now a serious legal challenge is underway that could end all 14 of them.
We believe we have a very strong case here, and it is based on law, and this logging is illegal. And it should stop.
That's former Greens leader Bob Brown, whose foundations launched action in the federal court to throw out Tasmania's regional forest agreement, which could spell the end for all regional forest agreements.
The Regional Forest Agreement Act of 2002 required there to be an agreement in place between Commonwealth and state, which would implement ecologically sustainable forest management. It patently isn't.
Instead, he says, native habitats are routinely destroyed, including through the burning of native forest areas covered by the Tasmanian Agreement. And that, in turn, is adding to pressure on native species, such as the swift parrot. 3 years ago, it was listed as endangered under the Federal Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Act. Bob Brown's action, supported by other environmental groups, argues the EPBC Act, which requires proper protection of listed species, is at odds with the Regional Forest Agreement Act, which gives loggers the right to destroy habitat.
What the groups have found, or a couple of groups have found, is a loophole or an intersect between the RFAs and the EPBC that they've been able to exploit.
That's Ross Hampton, CEO of the Australian Forest Products Association, which represents loggers. He's accusing Dr. Brown and his allies of so-called lawfare to blow up agreements, which have led to environmentally responsible logging practices for almost two decades.
Australia's natural forest or native forest operations are covered by the most strict environmental laws anywhere in the world.
And he's describing Dr. Brown's timing as appalling.
Most Australians would be just shaking their heads in disbelief at hearing that Bob Brown has taken this action. We've got a situation in the midst of a COVID crisis when jobs are falling like confetti. hundreds of thousands will be on the unemployment queues. And Bob Brown chooses this time to launch an action, which obviously if it was successful in Tasmania, he would take around the country, meaning we'd lose tens of thousands of valid, sustainable jobs.
The logging industry, which employs less than 1% of Tasmanians, every day is eroding forests, and therefore the much more job-rich hospitality and tourism industries, which are having a real struggle in Tasmania at the moment.
Former Greens leader Bob Brown and Tom Eagledon with that report. That's all from the World Today team for this week. Thanks very much for your company. The program's producer is Barbara Miller. Today's program was produced by Sarah Sedgie. The associate producer is Barney Porter. Research by Fatima Alumi and technical production by Scott Johnston. We'll be back at the same time on Monday. I'm Thomas Ariti. Stay safe and have a great weekend.